You don't get much more ledge than this afternoon's guest. A legend in your own lunchtime, Six Music listeners. It is Adam Ant.
Hi there.
I'm so pleased to meet you.
You too, yeah. We've missed each other. We have never done this before. So that's
well, you were massive before I got on the radio and had any chance to stalk people. And then you went off to LA and I was big on Radio 1. And
all right.
So we've never crossed, but it's really nice to meet you.
You too, thanks.
And before we start talking about your music and your new album, mm-hmm. which I've thoroughly enjoyed.
Thank you.
Can I just say, you've caused a frisson of excitement among women of a certain age,
oh.
i.e. my mates. I said to my mate Sal, I'm doing Adam Ant this afternoon. She goes, oh, I wish I was doing Adam Ant. He's well fit.
Oh,
there you are.
Well, that's very kind of her. Much appreciated.
Oh, don't say you don't like
that's
it.
Fair, no, I'd love it. It's great.
And thank then the other thing, so I've much. Tried to fix you up because I read, I think it was in The Independent, that you had a secret passion for Carol Vorderman.
Carol Vorderman, yeah, well, who doesn't really?
Well, I phoned fantastic. Her this morning. And she's texted me.
Oh, yeah.
Saying, oh, I'll tell you what she says. She says, oh, that's great. He's lovely. Give him my love.
Oh, okay.
So, not to give up, I then texted her back saying, I can do better than that. Do you want me to give him your phone number?
Okay.
She hasn't replied.
No, well, she's a professional person. I did actually meet her at the loose women thing once. Yeah. So that was enough, the photograph.
I'll put the phone to one side then.
Yeah.
Well, right. I'll send them all pictures later. Right, so this album, it's good value because it's 75 minutes or something of music, 16 songs and then an instrumental at the end. And really, lots of kinds of threads from your life going through it.
Yeah.
So, as we've touched on the subject of women and you being well fit, there's a few songs on here that are about love and ladies and stuff like that. So, Punk Young Girl, who's that about then?
That's about Kate Moss.
Oh, right.
Yeah, she's like this silent, iconic character, and she said various things over the years that I sort of picked up on the song. And I went to Paris and saw a Vivienne Westwood show, and it was one of the most bizarre, weird kind of sexy shows I've ever seen. And I thought, oh, that's going to make a song. So I kind of wrote it out of that.
All right.
It came from that, yeah.
Needs a middle-aged man whose midlife crisis you began.
Yeah, well, I think most of the guys in the audience feel that way at fashion shows. Very bizarre world, the fashion world. It's I'm not sure if it's about the clothes or the theatre or performance, but it was just kind of pretty honest, straightforward song about her.
And then you suggest somebody to her that's been on this show, and he was really fascinating. And how iconic and gorgeous was he in the 60s? Terence Stamp.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it's... I think she really is iconic, and she doesn't say very much. And I think that's...
She's part of a mystery.
Yeah, she's always stayed pretty much the same. She looks the same now as she did then, and I always sort of picked up on that. It's nice to... And she's a real British icon. It's nice to write about someone that's so important in culture, you know.
Yeah, are you having a midlife crisis?
I've had many. Who doesn't?
Since you were 21.
I bought the Harley Davidson, sold that.
You've been through the lot, haven't
you? Yeah,
okay, right. Dirty Beast.
Yeah.
That's nice. That's steamy.
Yeah, well, I was called that. I've been called that on many occasions because of the performances. But in a weird sort of way, it was a tribute to Marvin Gaye. I met Marvin Gaye when I did the Motown show. And I felt, you know, his death was very tragic. Mm. And I thought, you know, it was there'd not really been a tribute paid. So there's a line, listen to Marvin and weep. And at the end of his life, he was pretty much going on stage and just reduced it to just this dressing gown, and it would just drop off and he'd be there in his underwear, just standing there. And he was just like a very, very sexy guy. And I think, you know, it's a good way of, you know, owning up to the fact, you know, I'm a dirty devil on stage and why not? But it was just really moved me, Marvin Gaye's death.
Yeah, because you've appeared on stage in your pants, haven't you?
I did a tour called Strip.
Yeah.
And that was in a sort of glass water tank. And I went under and came out with just these shorts on, took these sort of leggings off. And just as the shorts were coming off, the lights went out. So that was... That got me banned over here. But I went to America. They quite liked it there.
Well, that'll get my friends going as well. Mm-hmm. If you listen. Hello, girls. I hope you're listening. Mm. And Stay in the Game. Yeah, I thought that... I hope you don't mind this analogy, but you can't help listening to me thinking, I just thought that the sound of it, the production, was very Billy Idol-esque.
Mm-hmm.
But the lyrics, everything's a lot like you. So who's that about then? Is it about a woman?
Yeah, I was in a relationship at the time, and it was just the way I feel about her. Just it sadly ended, but it was someone that sort of encouraged me to keep going in the business, not to give up, and about dreaming about her. And I kind of write what I think, and I write what I dream sometimes. That's what I put in there.
Now, the opening track and a couple of others on it as well, including the reprise at the end, which is like a theme tune, if you wanted it to be a theme tune for a cowboy film or a remake of Deliverance.
Right.
You can just hear the fact, you actually say Tennessee in it, that you lived in the sticks for a while and you lived the life and you had the pickup truck and the rest of it.
Yeah, it was a period of my life that nobody knew about it. We're getting married. I was getting married, my second marriage. And the plan was to, we got a 4x4, a pickup, 4x4 truck in Miami. And the idea was to drive to Vegas to the Elvis Chapel and get married in the Elvis Chapel. However, en route in the sort of depths of Tennessee, we stopped off in this little tiny town, and I saw an advert, and I went for a cup of coffee, and there's the adverts for properties, and I saw it's this A-framed house on the Vale of Tennessee. I couldn't believe it. That can't be how much it is. It was pretty cheap. Went up there, and I just fell in love with it. And I thought, if I don't do this now, I'm never going to do it. And I spent a couple of years living out there. Really, it was some of the most beautiful country I'd ever experienced in my life. And that's where it all stemmed from, the Cool Zombie side, the Cool Zombie song.
So did they get you? Did the locals get you? I mean, were you careering around in your pickup truck with your charged the Light Brigade jacket on and full makeup, or did you get yourself some hoedown dungarees and a check shirt?
No, it wasn't until I left that I think they really, they twigged I was a singer. But it was only my next door neighbour. There was a guy called Ron who was in the... he sadly passed away, and I attribute the song to him. And he sort of came over one day and said hi, and he had a Harley Davidson, and I had a little bike, and he took me off to visit some of his mates in the sort of deep south, and you go there and say hi, and you literally just get ha, that was it, that's all they'd say to you. And but I noticed along the way in the local small theatres and towns, it'd be like Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, all these sort of massive country stars who still did the circuit. So it was a really kind of they were just very, very friendly people, quite kept themselves to themselves, didn't say much. But I wasn't there for that. I was there to kind of just relax. And the best thing, my daughter was conceived there, so that was the wonderful part of it.
You didn't call her Smoky Mountain, or...?
No, I didn't call her Tennessee. Yeah. Although Tennessee's quite
a nice
name.
It's a nice name, yeah. Nashville.
Well, Brian Setzer called his son Dakota.
And there's Brooklyn.
It's a great name.
Yeah.
No, I'm not really into that too much. But Dakota was nice. To Cody,
I'm glad you did live there for a while, because you did certainly imbibe the sound. Some really nice songs seem to have come out of that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, what about LA? Because you did spend a long time there, didn't you? Carving out the other side of you, which is, it's not the other side, because I suppose you exploited that in all your videos and stage performances. Mm-hmm. The performance side of you. You went there to pursue your acting career, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, I started music in sort of 77. And about 85, all along people saying, you should do some acting and all the rest of it. But I was very reluctant to do it. And then I got offered a Joe Alton play at the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester with Sylvia Sims, who was one of my favourite actresses from the sort of 50s and 60s. And I think doing the experience of the play really stopped me to say, this isn't something you can tamper with. You can't do that and music. So I kind of made the decision to get out of music and really concentrate on acting. I went to LA, moved into a little sort of flat there. I just did loads of auditions and ended up doing sort of TV and some movies and worked with some good people. But you hear the word no, it's like, no thanks. Do this audition. You don't hear that as a musician, as a rock and roll singer. So I thoroughly enjoyed myself. And the most important thing was I enrolled in an acting class with this guy, Harry Mastro George. And that was a great sort of education for me. And it was nice to learn something in a completely different field.
Where did the flamboyant side of you come from originally, do you think?
I used to go to Saturday morning pictures when I was a kid, and they'd have all the kind of science fiction films, Errol Flynn film, pirate films. Yeah. And fortunately, I was that generation that saw rock and roll on TV, Ready, Steady, Go, and Thank Your Lucky Stars, Jukebox Jury. So every week you'd have the Stones, the Beatles, and all these bands on, and it was just I thought it was always there. It was always like, I really want to do that, and I think, even with Tommy Steele going way, way back, I remember seeing the Duke wore jeans at Saturday morning pictures, and I thought, ah, you know, this is something that I'd like to have a go at. So that was the seed of it.
And you're still sort of having an homage, get me, to the sort of 18th century. Mm. Even with the title of this album, mm. Adamant is the Blueback Hussar in Marrying the Gunner's Daughter, and that's one of the tracks on it. Mm-hmm. But with the uniform from mm. the Charge of the Light Brigade and mm. all the rest of it, where did all that fascination come from? Which was so... I mean, that's what differentiated you from everybody else in the early 80s.
Well, it was really the 1969 Tony Richardson film Charge of the Light Brigade, David Hemmings playing Captain Nolan. And the film just fascinated me. I just thought the look of it, the actual story of it. And I grew up in St John's Wood near the barracks, Royal Artillery Barracks. I used to see these guys go past when I was a little kid, all dressed up in that stuff. Right. So I think that kind of went in.
But and the Sergeant Peppers as well, did that?
Well, my mum worked for Paul McCartney. So, you know, I remember a little kid when they were doing, I think they must have been doing, Magical Mystery Tour, yeah.
Yeah.
And going, you know, in his house and seeing all the guitars all painted psychedelic and his sort of music room. And he was so nice to my mum. And I had this very privileged position in life to actually, my mum was working for one of the Beatles, you know, and it just totally overwhelmed me, yeah. I think, and it took a long time for it to actually come out until I went to art school and decided to take a chance, having seen the Sex Pistols, you know.
Well, just still on that historical stuff, I mean, does the romance of that era appeal to you, the look of it? Or?
Yeah, I think it's something that, it was certainly my favourite kind of look out of all of them, because yeah. I sort of changed it with each album, and this is really, I sort of came up with the idea, what would that guy look like 30 years later? If he'd walked to Moscow with Napoleon's Hussars and come back, you know, it's just I like to make the effort to dress up on stage, you know, mm. and also, you know, been involved in like designing it now, and the brocade I'm wearing now I've actually designed with a friend of mine. So
yeah, I've been looking online because it says online that you're bringing out a clothing range. I've been desperately trying to see some pictures of it, and it says it's coming out in April 13. We'll all be able to buy it.
Well, it's news to me, but it will come out eventually. But
I'm sitting here with my checkbook.
I'm trying it out. What I'm wearing on stage literally is the stuff that I've you know, we've designed together.
Yeah.
And these things take a long time, but we're talking to certain people now distributing it, and hopefully one day it'll be available.
Okay. Mm. Well, I can tell your listeners today, I should have said this, I should have painted a picture of the words, he's wearing a tweed flat cap and a woolly tartan scarf.
Yeah.
So not in character today.
No, it's nice to... I think if you walk down the street wearing your stage clothes, it wouldn't be special wearing them on stage, you know.
Now, talking of fashion, you've got a song called Vivian's Tears, which is obviously about Vivian Westwood. Mm. And you've got a song, next song on the album, Who's a Goofy Bunny, which is about...
Malcolm.
Buck Teeth Malcolm McLaren.
Well, yeah. It
was your mentor, wasn't he, really?
He was my mentor. My good friend Jordan, who worked in the shop, it was that sort of the joke, Who's a Goofy Bunny then. But I think, you know, when it went down with Bow Wow Wow and there was a sort of mutiny and they went their way and went my way.
Well, let's tell people, if Malcolm McLaren kind of pinched your band, stuck Annabella, what's she called?
Annabella Lewin.
Who was about 14 at the time, as front person, and left you high and dry.
I know, yeah, terrible, wasn't it?
Did you fall out?
Well, we were good mates. You know, we'd been playing gigs for sort of 3 years and it felt like a bit of a mutiny, but... In a way, I'm looking back on it now, and that's what I've done in the song. You know, I've tried to... I realised that Malcolm gave me a lot of really good advice and was really honest with me, and I think had we not had that break, I wouldn't have made Kings of the Wild Frontier.
Yeah, because he said to you that you making this music, it's like, indulge yourself in this when you've been established for 30 years, but let's make a hit album, for God's sake.
He just said, you know, what do you want? Do you want to be in the charts, or do you want to make a kind of record that, you know, is an independent record that no one hears, really?
Yeah.
And I just said, well, I want to make a pop record. And he said, well, you're going the wrong way about it. Or, you're going the wrong way about it, boy. And he just said, look, you know, you've got to put your face on the cover. And he just basically explained to me the rudiments of writing a pop tune, no verse, chorus, you know, first chorus, bridge, mid-late, you know. He made me listen to classic pop songs and rock and roll songs and study them. So he was like a mentor, and I think it got blown out of all proportion, obviously, at the time. And it was just nice to write a song for Malcolm when he died. Because I'm good friends with his son, Joe, and Ben. And, you know, it was written about the time that he actually sort of passed away, based on an idea I'd had earlier. But it's nice to... You know, write a tribute to Malcolm and Vivian because they're very important people in my life, you know.
Well, they're important people in our culture, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They've always had that anarchic side to them. They kind of take it. Malcolm certainly would take things to the edge and then walk away from it. He wouldn't actually put his flag in any situation. But very, very highly intelligent man. Very intelligent. And anybody that's ever, you know, spoken with Vivian, you know, she's a very intelligent lady. You know, you don't just sit there talking rubbish. You have to sort of think about it.
And as somebody who discovered the Sex Pistols because they were supporting you.
Mm.
At college and then got to know all that clan.
Mm-hmm.
Where would we be musically if that had never happened, do you think?
I think it was up until then. There were some very good bands about, the pub rock bands, you know, the Feel Goods and, you know, Ducks Deluxe and Kilburn in the High Roads. And they should basically have had, you know, record deals and been making records. But there was a sort of block, and I think the Sex Pistols came along, and it was really, when I saw them, it was the attitude. The songs were simple. They played them very well, and that was in November 75 when they were supporting the band I was in. I was in a college band called Bazooka Joe. And you could just see the clear, this attitude was, we don't care about that. We, you know, they were applauding, and John Lydon said, oh, you know, don't waste my time. No one had done that before.
Mm. So but it was a spirit then?
It was a spirit, the simplicity. I thought, well, I can play that. You know, it was like, I can play that. And it was just this sort of turned everything on its head. And I think it's taken a few years to sort of sink in just how important it was.
Well, there's a song on the album which they won't let me play, she said, having the spirit and looking at the authorities.
Yeah, there's a few.
Hanging over her. Uh-huh. And it's the favourite one of mine.
Oh, yeah.
But it's got some swearing in it.
Oh, yeah.
Hard men, tough blokes. I love it. I love the drumming on it.
Thank you very much.
I love the malice in it.
Mm.
It's just so punk. Is that fair?
Yeah, it is. It's
listeners will have to imagine it now.
It's tough. It's you know, when I first went to Hollywood to sort of audition, like, there was no room for British actors at all, and you'd get cast as a bad guy, which was okay. But since then, you know, there's this whole generation of hard blokes, and I just find it quite humorous as well. The fact that you can see they're putting it on, they do a great job, but it's a tribute to that kind of
Vinnie Jones, Ray Winston.
Yeah, I love them all. I think they're great. They're great, and it was just this tribute to them, really, in a sort of playful way. It's a very punky song. And I sent it to Ray Winston. He liked it before it came out.
That's,
you know,
brave.
Lucky.
I'll do you either. Well, listen, if you want to hear that one, you'll have heard some music during this interview from Adam's album. But if you want to hear Hard Men, Tough Blokes, which I will put on in the car going home and get my saw down, you'll have to buy the album, won't you?
Thank you.
Some sales, ka-ching.
Yeah.
It's Adam Ant with me on Six Music, and his latest album, Adam Ant, is the blueback hussar in Marrying the Gunner's Daughter.
Mm-hmm.
What a mouthful.
It is, definitely.
Right, let's come on to a subject that you want to talk about,
mm-hmm.
and I can totally empathise with, because I've lived with it. Cradle Your Head and Shrink. It's two songs. Now, am I right? Cradle Your Head's apologising for the impact that you've had on other people?
Cradle Your Hatred, yeah.
Hatred, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I think relationships get to a point where, you know, they're kind of over and they should be over, but you kind of, you punish each other and there isn't that kind of, that breaking point. You can't accept the fact that it's over. And everybody's, you know, you always feel you're right. And I think the song was sort of came out of that. And it's very... And Shrink, the other... You had mentioned Shrink.
Yeah.
Shrink is really dealing with, you know, what is now called bipolar disorder, you know, black dog, manic depression, which I very consciously decided as it being a part of my life to discuss openly in all the interviews. And it kind of... I'm glad I did because, I mean, the feedback from it has been enormous, just people writing me letters and... involved with this thing called the Black Dog Campaign, which is a sculptural thing where these black dog sculptures are made and various people designing them. And it's a taboo subject. It's something that's been swept under the carpet, but I can't think of anybody creative or sensitive who hasn't at some point encounter some kind of mental illness. And it is an illness, not a disease. So.
Yeah, people too. If you went to somebody and said, and I'm speaking from personal experience now, my relative's got cancer or my relative's got heart disease, you get loads of sympathy and people will be throwing themselves at you to help and want to talk about it. But this elephant in the room,
absolutely.
Mental health, it's so taboo. And that there's a campaign on the telly at the moment. Have you seen it? We need to talk about mental health.
No,
so even the NHS is recognising.
Mm. I think it's the responsibility you have if, you know, you're well known or whatever, and it's your choice. to, you know, either discuss it or not. But I think the thing is, it's every, what I've come out of it with is everybody's brain is completely unique to another, and it's not a sort of grand sweep of this is the condition. You know, anybody that's encountered bipolar disorder or any kind of mental illness is very individual. And I think that's why you have to go and pretty much have a very honest discussion with your doctor. You must see your doctor. You must discuss the medication you're on, what it's doing and how you feel. And I think people feel ashamed of it, and they shouldn't.
Can you feel it coming on? Do you think, oh, I'm doing okay, and then suddenly you think, hang on, because I've got a friend who says she can feel it coming on, and that's terrifying because she knows she's going to have to go back and get warnings.
I think there are warning signs that are pretty, you know, commonplace. But I think that I've basically tried to, the more you can educate yourself about the condition and why it is and what causes it. And this is, I was just lucky I had a doctor who was a psychiatrist who actually spoke to me about it. He said, well, no, you've got the choice of doing a lot of work yourself to find out as much as you can about it. So the information is out there. You just got to kind of try and seek it out and do a bit of work on yourself.
So can you explain, I don't want to pry too personally, but as you do want to, you know, get people talking about it, can you explain this? People say to me, how can he have become like that?
Mm-hmm.
How can he have, like, you know, lost everything, thrown it all away, behaved like that, and gone off the rails when he had everything, you know, attractive, successful in his chosen career, surrounded by beautiful wife and lovely kids and a nice roof over his head. Can you, Adam, explain how somebody who looks as though they've got everything can be so distressed?
Yeah, I think it's... I got myself into a frame of mind where I found it impossible to say no to work. And it was just almost, I think there'd been so many years of rejection that once I got my hit, it was just a, you know, I felt I've got to make this, I can't say no to anything, I've got to keep working. And it was absolutely ludicrous. I think it's, what's surprising is it that kind of disaster that eventually the bubble burst. It was miraculous. It hadn't happened before because, you know, I'd been working, and I didn't let myself stop. And I think the stress of that and the kind of exhaustion of that had a great deal to do with it. The other facets of it are, as I say, you know, they're highly personal. You have to kind of, you know, they can do with it. They can be something to do with your childhood. They can be, you know, because it is an illness. It's not a disease, but understanding it is a very, you know, it's a job you have to do. It's part of the recovery. You have to do some work on yourself and you have to listen to what the doctors are saying to you. And it's a very complex subject.
And it must be even harder when it's being played out in the tabloids.
Comes with the territory. You know, that's the sort of things that happen. But a lot of creative people kind of fall prey to it, I think, because really, I just thought, you know, you're making your living out of sort of abstract ideas. It's not, you're not going in, you're not checking in to do a job. Check in and there's a relaxation after you check off at six. You're looking for inspiration, lyrics, abstract ideas and turn them into music. So it's this magical world. It's a very privileged profession. And like anything, there are ups and downs in it. And with music, people want to hear the dark and the light. And to be an artist, you need to write about the highs and the lows. So given that, it's hardly surprising in a way that this condition, which is bipolar, means up and down, does occur.
Or manic depression.
Manic depression.
So what do you hope comes out of you talking about it and people becoming more aware? And
I think the main thing is to not feel ashamed and to just kill the taboo, you know, to just kind of, it's not a taboo, you shouldn't be ashamed of it, because it is an illness and one day it will be cured. The more we learn about the brain, one day, hopefully, those things that people, that kind of behaviour, they'll know exactly why it's happening and be able to treat it. So I'm hopeful.
And don't avoid people. Help them like you would if they were poorly in physically.
Absolutely.
Oh, anyway, you might get a few good songs out of it for your new album. So I've had a right good chat and, you know, sprinkling of the music off the album. I can't play my favourite song off the album because this is the BBC and you were a bit potty-mouthed. But which song are you most proud of? What should I play?
I like Shrink, really.
We've spoken about.
It's a little bit, it sort of encompasses a little kind of nod to what it's like to be in therapy and listening to that. You know?
Okay, well, before I play that, I did find out a few secrets, like I said at the start of this, that you had a little bit of a penchant for Carol. Borderman. Oh, but I also found out that you had another guilty pleasure, musically.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny, because this is one of mine as well, because whenever I go to Spain, as soon as I get by the pool, I put this CD on, the speakers full blast, and I shimmy around the pool with my sangria. Are you ready for a bit of Julio?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, don't. I love this record.
I do, too.
I love this record.
Oh. Are you ready?
Oh, no. I've got a great Julio story, though. Oh, dear.
Oh, well, let him sing a bit, then tell us.
I will.
Go on, then. Tell us the story. Tell us the story.
All right, I did a show in Paris, this big TV show or whatever, and we arrived late. We were really tired, and Julio was on. I thought, Julio's on. This is great.
Yeah.
And we went on and did our rehearsal. And then Julio came in and, suited up, orange. And and he went up to the producer and he said, I want to be out the building when he comes on. I was absolutely devastated.
Oh, well.
I was devastated.
Oh, I'm tempted not to play this anymore.
No, I forgive him. He's all right. That's true. Oh, I love this video. Look at the curry.
I actually brought the album.
I know.
One more blast. So there's an exclusive. You won't hear Adamant anywhere else singing Amor Julio Iglesias, except on 6 Minutes. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
All the very best with this. I know you're doing loads of shows, and I'll give out the details.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
Yeah, and the album, again, if you want to hear that top track with all the expletives, is in your shops now. Thank you very much. So here's the chosen track from the album. Thank you, Adamant.
Thanks very much.